Welcome to Living on Lopez, Backyard Conservation. I'm Madrona Murphy.
And I'm Russell Barsh.
And we're your hosts for Living on Lopez. Last month started our series on the special public lands on Lopez by talking about Lopez Hill, rich in mosses and home to the elusive northwestern salamander.
This month we'll be talking about another special place, Iceberg Point, which is owned by the Bureau of Land Management. Iceberg Point is home to some of the rarest plant species on Lopez and is probably the best place on Earth to see lots of marbled murrelets, as well as other seabirds and marine mammals.
As you know, all the views and opinions expressed on this program are those of your hosts, us, and any guests we might have, and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of KLOI or GIV.
So let's locate ourselves on Iceberg Point. This is a piece of land with an interesting history. Like much Bureau of Land Management property in the archipelago, it was originally a Coast Guard reserve. Coast Guard and military reserves gradually ended up being transferred to the Bureau of Land Management, and in some cases the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Iceberg was under Coast Guard administration until the 1970s. And finally, in 1990, was designated as an area of critical environmental concern by the Bureau of Land Management as a, essentially as a special place, but without a special plan. That's still to come. Currently, Iceberg Point is under consideration as one part of a national conservation area for the San Juan Islands archipelago, and it would give it higher status and make it part of a network of islands, rocks, reefs, points, promontories in San Juan County and our neighboring counties that would be administered with a high concern for conservation, beauty, and human activity.
One of the unique things about Iceberg as a piece of public land on Lopez is that it's not entirely publicly accessible. In order to reach Iceberg from public roads, one has to cross significant amounts of private property, and there isn't actually an access easement across these properties. So for periods of time in its history, Iceberg has been accessible only by water. At this point, and for a long time, it's been accessible by the good grace of the neighbors who allow people to cross the land. So if you've ever put your car in the wrong place up at Iceberg and gotten a note from one of the monitors, there's a good reason for that. One of the things that allows us to access this beautiful property is that the neighbors are willing to let folks walk across their land. So we try very hard to respect their space. And so that's why people are consistently reminding you to park down at Agate Beach and walk on in. And I always think that the long walk just makes the anticipation of getting out to the meadows of Iceberg all the more exciting.
Let's take a look from the kind of the bottom up at Iceberg Point. Let's start with the bedrock geology. That's not usually what you go out to Iceberg Point to see, but to a geologist and to a student of geology, it's an incredible place. Iceberg Point is right on the edge of a major fault zone. The rocks there are part of what's called an imbricate zone, which is to say it's all a jumble of different pieces of different plates that were scraped and rubbed together and rose and fell and shattered over many, many, many millions of years. So that you're walking along the edge of history, so to speak, as you follow the trail along the shoreline at Iceberg Point. The rocks on the upland side, a jumble of rocks of covering tens of millions of years, and part of a small plate, the small San Juan Island plate that you're walking along the edge of, is one of the marvels of geological sleuthing. Over the years, geologists have discovered that this tiny dish that we're on that contains the islands is really a tiny piece of bedrock series that probably came from about Northern California. And as the huge Pacific and continental plates rubbed and slid against each other, the plate that forms the edge between the Pacific Ocean and North America, this little dish, this little chunk, got itself rolled northwards until it finally crashed into the smaller plate of Wrangellia of what's now Vancouver Island and came to rest. So we're on a little tiny dislodged piece of Northern California that has been jammed up into the bedrock system of the Pacific Northwest region here. And Iceberg Point is the place to see it, because there you are on the ruffled, wrinkled edge of this particular plate. Look for the Orcas Chert. It's a band or series of bands of grayish cherty that's a sort of waxy to translucent mineral that runs through many of the rocks at Iceberg and also at Colville, and is a basis for some of the dating that's been done of those rocks.
One of the nice things about Iceberg in terms of checking out the bedrock and the geology is because of its exposure, a lot of the rock has been wiped or blown clean. And you can see one of the fun things out at Iceberg is there's some absolutely stunning glacial grooving exposed, where you can see directly where the glaciers had scraped big scratches in the rock. If you go up to where the survey marker, the boundary marker that people call a monument, is, there's some absolutely stunning glacial grooving, and it makes one feel very small and very fast-moving when you think about the history of the landscape. Also a good example of how convoluted, how tipped and twisted the rocks here are, that unlike the sort of school model of layer cake, where you have the oldest rocks on the bottom and everything sort of tidally layered on up to the top. On Iceberg, a lot of the rocks are on edge. Sometimes you'll find the oldest rocks above the lowest rocks. And there are points when you can step across maybe a foot and change from entirely one series of rocks to an entire different series. So it's sometimes fun to go out there and pretend that all the amazing plants and animals there don't exist and just focus on the rocks.
And if you look for the most recently uncovered rocks, when you head out towards where the automated beacon is, where the lighthouse used to be, you will notice that many of the shoreline rocks are just beautifully polished. They don't look like they're weathered at all. These are parts of the underlying bedrock that have been exposed by the sea only within the last few years. We're seeing accelerating erosion around the edges of Iceberg Point. The good side of that is it's showing us some of the underlying glacial geology that has been buried under glacial till for 10,000 years. And the bad side is it's taking out some of the meadowlands. It's beginning to encroach on the open areas that are many people's reason for loving the place. So keep an eye on that. We are, I would say that Iceberg Point is one of the most interesting and obvious exposures of the process of sea level rise and climate change that you can see around Lopez Island and throughout the San Juan Islands.
So Iceberg has clearly been an important place to people for a very long time. This goes back long beyond the Coast Guard ownership. There's good evidence that it's an area where people were growing camas and other food plants. There's soil evidence of extensive gardens where people had actively been turning the soil and burning to return some of the organic matter to the soil, and also to remove some of the woody species, which we'll talk more about later as to how what a big impact that has been. But also, if you go around toward what we call Reef Neck Cove, out by the beacon there, out around the corner, you will see a spot that was a very important reef netting site. Actually, it continued to be an important reef netting site up through the 90s, although the actual location of the anchors changed from Coast Salish reef netting to more modern reef netting.
The reef netting is interesting in more than one way, not just ethnographically, I suppose, or in terms of marine resources. It also involved some unusual human modification of the coastline, because the old reef nets before the 1940s had to be held down by something, and often big stones or big rocks were used as anchors. Coast Salish peoples pried rocks off of the exposures of bedrock along the coast, and used big slabs of rock as the anchor stones for their reef nets. There's a considerable pile of them down at about 120 feet, about 20 fathoms, off Reef Net Cove, and they are slabs of rock pried off of Iceberg Point. So long before there was blasting, as there was, for example, at Waldron's Point Disney to provide paving stones for Seattle, there was prying and the use of coastal quarries by Coast Salish peoples in order to anchor their reef net fleet.
This was quite an undertaking. The reef net boats required very large stones, and I think you needed at least four in order to set a reef net gear, and people often set multiple gear in a year. And so these huge stones were set by taking them out on a slab set between two canoes and rolling them down into exactly the right spot. So people who knew where to anchor their reef net gear were very valued. They were the people who had the expertise to ensure that the gear was set in the right place and would catch a lot of fish. But if you imagine putting down four huge stones every year, that's an awful lot of work.
There was an awful lot of work also, presumably, in the gardening that we have soil profile evidence for. Scores, at least, of identifiable garden plots, about a 16th of an acre to an 1/8 of an acre or so, scattered about in a checkerboard across the iceberg landscape. And each one of those would have been a little field, probably surrounded by at least a symbolic stone fence, as observed by early explorers and settlers, and maintained, like any garden, by clearing and weeding and hoeing in the spring, and clearing off again in the fall, possibly burning to set up for the following year's season. As you could imagine, Iceberg Point, as it might have been 300 or 400 years ago, it would have been a checkerboard of little garden plots with stone fences, woodlots, very much like the small field system in the English countryside that developed in the Middle Ages. So people were putting a lot of time into modifying and transforming the Iceberg Point landscape, a point to which we need to return when we consider what we should be doing today for tomorrow.
One interesting thing that people did not put work into, that for some reason there are stories that they did, are the big granite boulders down at Iceberg that are apparently the source of the name Iceberg. There is no evidence that these were put there by people. In fact, their pattern along the coastline is consistent with glacial deposition. They're essentially just particularly striking glacial erratics that are scattered along the iceberg coastline. And people put their work into moving their anchor stones and didn't bother with those white rocks. One important thing to consider, though, in terms of the location of Iceberg and the fishing camp that would have been in that area, is that you could, from Reef Net Cove, from the point where the beacon is, you can see all the way across to Cattle Point. And you're also very close by Outer Bay, into McKay Harbor, some of the Davis Bay, Long Island, some of the other important sites for people. All of these can be seen from each other, and people could signal to each other between these. There was a watch house over at Cattle Point, over at the where the DNR has property there, where folks could let each other know if there were issues, particularly northern raiders. And in fact, one of the points near Iceberg has defensive trenches on it where people could protect themselves. It's a point that's inaccessible by water, and a defensive trench to protect it from land, so that people who were fishing at a time when there were an awful lot of northern raids going on, could sort of retreat to this point and fend off raiders, at least at the point when they didn't have modern firearms.
Despite the extensive evidence of human occupation and use of Iceberg Point going back truly thousands of years, and possibly to some extent because of it, the point has some of the most extraordinary natural features, natural in the sense of native species of plants and animals sustained by this wonderful coastal, open, windswept coastal landscape, in addition to many of the rare plants that are scarce in on the island, or scarce indeed even statewide. Of course, with the plants, butterflies, terrestrial birds, the coastline around Iceberg Point is probably about as much a hot spot for seabirds as any part of San Juan County. It's particularly rich in marbled murrelets. It supports a majority of the marbled murrelet population in western Washington, but other alcid seabirds, the murres and rhinoceros auklets and grebes and every single species you might imagine that you've seen is either foraging or nesting around Iceberg Point at some point in the year. So, indeed, it's a combination of a very interesting terrestrial environment with an extraordinary marine environment that, to a great extent, the land feeds. The marine environment ultimately is about phytoplankton production, primary production of marine plants that form the foundation of the marine food web, and the nutrients for that are running off the edges of the bluffs and the rocks at Iceberg Point, protected, as it were, by the native vegetation and the structure of the landscape that has resulted from these thousands of years of human activity. A beautiful example of a cultural space that feeds one of what has really become one of our marine natural treasures, this huge seabird hotspot.
If you think about what people were doing with the land, it definitely had an active role in feeding the marine environment. So the upland farming would have returned some of the nutrients that people added to the land by using seaweed and fish waste to fertilize their gardens. Then burning vegetation, some of the nutrients that were returned to the soil would also have continued to run down through the meadows at Iceberg and ended up in the marine environment. So burning was one way of transferring terrestrial nutrients to the marine environment. But then also in the fishing, people returned a good portion of the fish to the water. So even though they were harvesting a huge amount of marine protein, a lot of that went back directly, and then some of it was kept on land to help feed the plants and eventually slowly trickled back in. So even though it was a very intensive active management, it managed to support this lively marine environment and this very diverse terrestrial environment. When we think about farming, we tend not to think of farming as supporting unique rare plant species. And yet at Iceberg, we do. We have an amazing amount of plants that don't really grow elsewhere in this area. We have at least 3 state-listed sensitive species, including slender crazy weed, the only patch of white-topped aster that is between here and, I think, Vancouver Island, and then down to Whidbey. So it's a unique little patch of white-topped aster. There's California buttercup everywhere, which is practically absent from the rest of the state. And then we have a lot of plants that are virtually absent from the rest of Lopez, and yet are, if not abundant, at least very obvious out at Iceberg, like the showy Jacob's ladder, the polemonium. Yampa, Pruderidia gardneri, which is a plant that people also gardened and harvested. It's in the carrot family and has a sweet root and is super rare in San Juan County, but it has abundant patches down at Iceberg. Also, there's patches of satin flower, which is a little iris relative that blooms very early in the spring. If you get out in March and April around the monument, you'll see this amazing kind of purpley-maroon flower that opens up right in those moss and lichen meadows. Some little bit of Menzies larkspur. There's actually a patch of shooting star, which is abundant on some of the other islands, but pretty rare on Lopez, and yet it persists at Iceberg in a landscape where people were actively farming. So clearly the way in which people interacted with the land is different than what we're doing now, and managed to support some of these rare plant species even while people were removing a huge amount of food from the landscape.
And this coexistence of pre-Columbian farming, fishing, seabirds, diversity of native flowering plants is extraordinary. Iceberg, we would contend, is not a beautiful example of a relic natural space, but a very important example of a cultural space, which was cultural but coexisting or blended with a very vibrant and diverse system of plants and wildlife compared to many of the areas that we have intensively managed in more recent years. So that if we look at Iceberg, it sets a kind of a challenge to us to be able to produce food and occupy a space without reducing the diversity of birds and plants and eliminating the things that are so extraordinary there that today, all too often, are assumed to be at Iceberg Point because it's natural, untouched, pristine, unoccupied, that they are there, people suppose, for all the reasons that are in fact not true, that that humans were not there.
Right. The assumption being that these have persisted despite humans, and we would counter that to some extent the landscape is there because of humans. The individual species may have taken advantage of that, but it's not despite humans that these rare species are there. I wanted to mention one other particularly delightful aspect of spending time at Iceberg, which is that it's a fabulous place to view marine mammals from land. There are some rocks, also belonging to the Bureau of Land Management, right off of Iceberg, that are particularly enjoyed by harbor seals. And from the top of the monument, in fact, if you're there on the right day, you'll catch up with, in the summer, you'll catch up with the BLM staff who have binoculars and spotting scopes to help you enjoy marine mammals. Also, it's one of the places on Lopez, one of the few places on Lopez where you can expect to see orcas passing by. And I want to put in a pitch here for watching marine mammals from land, because their behavior is much more natural from land. They expect big mammals to be on land. They don't seem to be disturbed by humans on land at all, and will come quite close to the shore. And you can observe more normal behavior rather than their response to boats or to the noise of people on the water. And Iceberg is one of the public lands on Lopez where you can expect to see them. Also being, as it is, open down towards Admiralty Inlet, you occasionally will see some of the other whales that travel through the islands that are a little less commonly sighted, such as minkies. So it's a very good place to spend some time on the land watching what goes on in the marine environment, not just the birds, but also the marine mammals. And if you're very patient, you can watch fish. We went out a couple years ago out by ReefNet Cove and watched the most amazing school of small fish, of herring, move around that point. And they took hours to get round. It was amazing how many fish. And just standing on the rocks there, looking down and seeing the silver as they move their way around the corner there.
And if you're really patient and enjoying a picnic at Iceberg, you may also see the other important landscape transformer there, which are the humble little voles that turn the land about this time of year into the winter into a Swiss cheese of vole holes and vole burrows. But just as much as we see the fingerprints of humans all over the landscape at Iceberg to an extraordinary degree. We also see the claw prints of voles that basically were doing much of the same thing, digging, transplanting when they built little caches of food for themselves, rearranging the vegetation and aerating and rearranging the soils all across this landscape. And it's important because their presence there is both a cause and an effect of having an open herbaceous landscape, primarily herbaceous plants, primarily soft vegetative matter rather than woody material. They are basically farmers of herbaceous vegetation and consumers of it. And so voles and humans historically shared the job of managing and turning over the meadowlands at Iceberg to a degree that we can see only half of today. If you watch voles clean out one small part of the landscape, busily digging up all of the bulbs and seeds that they can find, and then busily replanting them.
Yes, vole gardening is kind of amazing, and also it gives you an opportunity to take a look at the soil at Iceberg. So one thing that helps us understand the human history is looking at the soil, but you wouldn't want to go out there and dig it because it's a very sensitive landscape, and so you have to wait for the voles to do that for you. And if you look at the back dirt from vole excavations, you'll see that the soil is rich black soil, rich in organic matter, but also rich in charcoal, and that it's pretty uniform. Where the voles are, there's often some rocks in there. Where people were gardening extensively, oftentimes those have also been removed. And then the other fun thing to see is what grows in vole back dirt. They are incredibly good at propagating harvest brodeas and chocolate lilies. But there's definitely some other plants that take advantage of all of these vole excavations. Just a note on what voles are. Sometimes they're called meadow mice. They're small, fat rodents that are closely related to lemmings and that spend most of their time in little runways above ground that are not actually tunnels. They look kind of like the divots people make when they're playing cheating at croquet. If you imagine a nicely tamped down small area that voles like to run through. And then they also have burrows in which they store food. And they like their relatives, the lemmings. They go through population booms and busts. And if you spend much time in an area with voles, or if you have a garden in an area with voles, you will definitely experience these huge population swings. And raptors love to eat voles. So one fun thing to watch out at Iceberg is keep your eye out for the voles and enjoy at the same time watching the raptors, who are also looking for them with their sharp eyes.
There's all sorts of things then that you can enjoy at Iceberg Point, which is what makes it so special as a public place. Why don't we take a break here for station identification and then return to the question of how to take care of this place? You're listening to KLOI LP from Lopez Island, Washington, 102.9 FM, and this is Living on Lopez Backyard Conservation.
So Iceberg is, as we've told you, a landscape that people have been intimately involved in for a very long time. And it's a landscape that is changing because of changes in the ways that people interact with it. If you spend much time at Iceberg, particularly if you've spent time at Iceberg over the last 20 to 30 years, you will have seen some dramatic changes. And they're not from what people are actively doing on the landscape. So you wouldn't see the kind of changes you'd expect from, you know, logging or farming or extensive trail building. Instead, what you see are the changes that happen when people stop doing what they're doing. After Coast Salish management of Iceberg, which we've described more than the other phases, the Coast Guard took over ownership. And like many Coast Guard sites, that meant that the land had a family on it who looked after the Coast Guard station. And like most of those, they also had livestock, sheep, and there was some farming done. There apparently was at least a pea patch out there at one point. So that's a dramatic transition from Kosalij active gardening to livestock. And we can see that transition quite dramatically in the non-native grasses that are hugely abundant out at Iceberg. These are mostly the very tall grasses that are along the sides of the trails. There's two main grasses, orchard grass, which has kind of a rabbit foot-like seed head, and tall fescue, which is just as large, has kind of more sharp blades of grass. It's the kind that will give you grass cuts very easily, and very tall seed heads that vaguely resemble some of the smaller fescues. The other effect of sheep, though, for a long time, was to keep woody vegetation from colonizing by grazing everything down. Although, as you see in a lot of old pastures, some of the vegetation they don't like to eat, and you end up with things like roses coming in over time.
The introduction of sheep as the major mower in this system created an interesting problem for management in terms of the kind of management practiced by native people previously. Much of the pre-Columbian or pre-contact management of the Iceberg landscape was hoeing, weeding, and burning relatively frequently, probably just every few years, burning off the dry, dead down material and the few little shrubs that had begun to stick their heads up. In the landscape as it existed prior to sheep, fire would have the beneficial effect of wiping out most of the new emergent woody vegetation without affecting the bulbs that people were trying to grow underground. The soils are sufficiently good insulators that you can burn off little seedling Doug firs and little seedling roses without overheating the bulbs that are 3 or 4 inches down below the surface. But with the introduction of sheep and sheep grasses, we have Eurasian plants, the grasses, that actually like fire, that come from an environment in the European and Asian steppes where the major renewal mechanism for grasses was periodic wildfires. So that when you burn the post-sheep landscape, instead of reducing woody vegetation, what you do is promote grass.
We did some experimental burns in landscape near Iceberg and found that some of the grasses, the type of burning that would have been done in a Kosalij garden, a very light, flashy, small-scale burn, doesn't even kill off the crowns of some of these grasses. They build these huge crowns of living stalks and old dead leaves, which actually can make the fire much hotter and increase the risk of damaging some of the root zone in terms of the bulbs, but protect these grasses pretty well. It's interesting, though, that to remember that when Kosalij gardens were there, even though people did use fire as a way of helping to clear them more actively and more regularly, they were weeding them. So even the native grasses, of which there are some out at Iceberg, were not as much a component of the landscape during Kosalij management as they are now. So, in fact, one of the effects of sheep, in addition to bringing in non-native grasses, may have been to promote some of the native grasses, which are a little more resistant to grazing and trampling than some of the bulbs are. Camas, in particular, can survive grazing pressure, but it reduces the size of the bulbs because they can't feed themselves as well and makes it harder for it to reproduce because very often one of the things that will be eaten on camas is the unripe seed pods, which seem to be, at least for deer, the preferred portion of the plant to chew on.
No, it's important to consider that there wasn't very much to burn when Kosalij people were managing Iceberg Point. A little bit of herbaceous vegetation. The weeds were mostly small native forbs, flowering plants that people did not eat, and some native grasses. And because you couldn't really get much of a fire going without woody plants, which people didn't want to have at all in their gardens, you end up with small burns, light burns, and the need to continually weed, very much like in any modern garden. It's only when you have substantial woody material that you can get a big fire going. But by that time, from a Coast Salish point of view, it's too late. But let's talk about wood. I mean, this is interesting. We have no really precise measure at this point of when native peoples began to use fire, hoeing, weeding, and gardening camas and other plants. Probably from the archaeological evidence, somewhere between 2,500 and 3,000 years ago. Certainly fire pits for roasting camas from about 3,000 years ago from Whidbey Island. So let's say 2,500 to 3,000 as the beginning of cultivation. At that point, conditions were about as cool and wet as they are today. They had been cooling down for a couple of thousand years from the warmer, drier period preceding the this era, and the woodlands around the Camas Gardens would have been not particularly very much different than they are today. Perhaps a higher proportion of some of the pines and some of the drier season plants are more drought tolerant than our cedars and firs, but definitely not, deciduous forests or dry deciduous forests, which had disappeared already several thousand years earlier. So what people were doing initially, very much like the peoples of Southeast Asia and the Pacific do to this day, was burning holes in a coniferous forest and maintaining those holes on a tight rotation, that is to say, not letting too much grow back, for maybe 3,000 years, during which time the rest of the landscape changed. Occasionally fires got loose and ran through the trees. People introduced new plants and animals, and of course Europeans introduced more new plants and animals. And at this point, it is difficult to say that in a complete sense that what happens when you stop clearing the landscape and it starts growing roses, Himalayan blackberries, and Doug firs, that this is returning to a natural state or returning to a pre-cultural state. It is perhaps to the extent that it's returning to being a woodland, which in the absence of wildfires, lightning strikes, big windstorms and tsunamis is what tends to happen here. On the other hand, we have to consider that most of the things that provide diversity and support for birds, butterflies, and other creatures here only exists in the non-wooded areas of our landscape, and humans had increased that.
Yeah, what makes Iceberg so special to us are the things that are there because people took care of it. And while we can argue a great deal over whether the current encroachment of woody species, particularly Douglas fir, Nootka rose, and snowberry, whether that's a natural process, it's hard to make that an easy argument, because the landscape that they invaded was primed for their invasion by a series of different human disturbances, starting with Coast Salish management, followed by sheep, which were removed from the land when the Bureau of Land Management took over and they took a hands-off policy. And that transition has been occurring during a time of less management. So it raises interesting questions of what do we want at Iceberg? What do we want to protect? Is there a natural state for Iceberg Point? And I would argue there probably isn't a natural state, given that it is an anthropogenic landscape. That's to say, it's a landscape that was created through human activity. So that gets us to the question of what do we want to see there? Do we want to promote all of these rare species that we don't get to see very many other places, and which may be hanging on in this area because of places like Iceberg? But that might require a lot of intervention.
In fact, one of the things that makes this all particularly interesting for us islanders is the fact that typically islands, if they're not inhabited by people, have pretty thin ecosystems, pretty thin trophic webs. It's hard for animals and plants to get to islands. And islands typically have what ecologists call depauperate ecosystems. Fewer animals and plants than the mainland. Fewer of them got there. Certain groups that had trouble getting there, often things like reptiles, the ones that are not aquatic, like turtles, never got there at all, any of them, so that you have an ecosystem which is missing some major components. What is so interesting about the San Juan Islands as a whole is being close enough to the mainland for people to have been very active in reshaping these landscapes and making them in some ways more like the landscapes and ecosystems of the mainland. But then on the other hand, because of our geology, topography, hydrology, and the extent to which many of the animals and plants here did not come with human intervention, but were filtered by the process of dispersal over water anyway, this is a different kind of food web, different kind of ecosystem in the end than is on the mainland. So we have what we could call artificially rich ecosystems in the islands because of human activity historically, and part of that was the extent to which people maintained open spaces, suppressed woody vegetation, and encouraged, very strongly promoted, the flowering plants and the small fruiting shrubs, like the berries, that they found delightful, beautiful, and edible. And so did the birds and the small mammals, in creating this whole peculiar, rather richer than it would otherwise have been, ecosystem. And then letting it continue to essentially go back into a woody system, well, on the one hand, it will be certainly less diverse than it has been for the last several thousand years. But also it will be different. A beautiful example of that is Himalayan blackberry, which is hugely abundant in all of the post-sheep environments here in the islands. Invasive, non-native, it does produce good forage for some birds and animals, but it's also highly aggressive and in fact, if we do nothing, will take over a larger and larger part of the landscape. So, is that a natural process? Well, the blackberries got here because of us.
It's interesting. Part of what's important about Coast Salish management isn't that they did the same thing everywhere. What makes these islands diverse was that there was a diverse economy in terms of what Coast Salish people were doing with the land. If they'd treated everywhere on Lopez like iceberg, we would not have the amount of diversity that we currently have. So it's important to consider that part of how you create diversity on a small scale, like the islands, is to have different management at different sites. So it is important to look at iceberg as something unique. What's there now? How did people create the environment that allows those things to exist? And how do we promote that uniquely for iceberg? It's not as simple as going back and saying, well, Coast Salish people had camas gardens, they weeded and they burned, because they certainly didn't have to deal with a lot of the weeds we have now, such as Himalayan blackberry and bull thistle, nor with the sheep grasses. While Coast Salish had livestock, they were non-grazers. They had woolly dogs, and I'd have no idea whether iceberg was a place that they allowed their woolly dog flocks to hang out. So there have been a lot of steps to assemble the current iceberg landscape. And as Russell and I often say, you can never go backwards in an ecosystem. You can only go forwards. The assembly rules, the way in which the landscape and ecosystem got to be the way it is now, will determine its future forever. So all we can do is take additional steps. And the question with iceberg is, what are those steps? Some considerations. There's a lot of rare species at iceberg that don't occur elsewhere. Anything done in a disturbance on a land scale landscape scale has the potential to extirpate some of those rare species. These include the plants, the butterflies. There's a lot of land birds that hang out at Iceberg. The lichen diversity there is wonderful. And one of the things to keep in mind when you're at Iceberg is that those beautiful reindeer lichens are very sensitive to foot traffic. And they're also quite sensitive to fire. Mosses and lichens don't respond well, other than we have an invasive moss that really likes fire. But most mosses and lichens are quite sensitive to fire. Fire applied to the current landscape would be very hot because there's so much woody material. And there's also a lot more grass biomass than would have been there in the past. We have seen some experimental clearing of woody species. And insofar as the ground under some of the Douglas firs is currently free of vegetation, one of the things that often happens is that the most aggressive species seed that land when the Douglas firs are removed. So bull thistles, invasive grasses, are often the first thing to get a hold in that new soil. Also the plantain, that's an invasive all over Iceberg, will be one of those things that comes in new disturbance. There have been some experiments with meadow restoration in this area, broadly speaking, what people call the Puget Trough, which includes landscapes that are quite a lot different from the San Juans, but often the San Juans are sort of lumped in with them. And those restoration projects are typically done on a relatively large scale, and they almost always involve the use of extensive spraying of herbicides. For example, out at American Camp and on Yellow Island. So there's a question of, is that the kind of restoration we want to use, given how sensitive the marine environment around Iceberg is, and that we're not only dealing with a very sensitive terrestrial environment and some very sensitive species, but also a very rich, very diverse marine environment where some of our rarest birds hang out.
And we are facing a kind of a critical decision point. Iceberg Point has been left pretty much to its own devices now for a little over 20 years. And during that time, I would estimate from what we've seen out in the field that about one half of the flowering meadowlands have disappeared. So in 20 years of benign neglect, I think benign neglect is probably a good term for it, of a well-intentioned neglect, we've lost half of the plants and landscapes that have historically been considered so special there. The open vistas with native wildflowers. And the areas that remain, if you look very closely, are slowly being taken over by blackberries and grasses, Eurasian grasses, so that it's not just a reduction of the open space, a replacement of open space with woodlands, but a thinning of the native wildflower component in the open meadows that's taking place. So we don't have much longer to decide what we're going to do, if we're going to do anything. Fire, again, is problematic because of its effect on invasive species, its promotional effect on invasive species. Any kind of large-scale use of herbicides, very problematic, not only because of the effect on the terrestrial environment and terrestrial animals, but the fact that this entire landscape drains right into Seabird Central for the North Sound. Hand clearing, well, I mean, that's basically what native people did, as they were on their hands and knees a lot when they were taking care of this landscape. And hand clearing, of course, can be, though tedious, very selective and involve minimal disturbance of soils and even gradual reduction in canopies, like girdling some trees so that they die back slowly and you have time to do other things rather than just toppling the tree and ending up with a stump and a lot of sunlight. So a gardening approach to a landscape like Iceberg, which selectively removes some of the plants that are encroaching and some of the plants that are invasive and problematic, and selectively promotes some of the things that we really don't want to lose, though time-consuming and expensive may be the only alternative we have.
So what can you do? How do you help look after iceberg? Well, one of the important things is right now the Bureau of Land Management is going through a resource management planning process, and there's also this effort to have the BLM lands in the San Juans designated as National Conservation Area, and I would encourage you to get involved in these processes and make sure that your experience of iceberg is part of that planning process, so that decisions made about where we go from here involve the Lopez community, because you're the ones who are going to be exploring iceberg in the future, and if it involves extensive use of manual labor, you're the potential pool of volunteers, and until the agencies know that they have this pool, they'll be reluctant to embark on processes that involve a lot of people. But I think this is a landscape that people in Lopez care about enough that we would probably want to be a big part of any restoration changes. The other thing is to help document what's out at iceberg now. We've got a bird survey going on there, a seabird survey that Kelly is leading. If you check out icebergpointproject.org, you'll see what they've been finding. There's a wonderful list of birds out there. Take a look when you're out walking at iceberg and you see something really fun, make a note. Look for some of those rare plants that you'd seen in the past and maybe haven't seen so often in the future. And I hate to say this, but follow the rules while you're at iceberg. There's a lot of land birds. There's a lot of ground nesting birds, which is the reason that dogs are supposed to be on leashes. And the reason that there are quite some extensive paths. And while some of the flowers occur off path, it's amazing how much grows right around the edge of the path. So trying not to trample, particularly those sensitive lichens and mosses. But the big thing is starting to think about where you want this landscape to go, what things have been precious to you there, and getting involved in the planning process to support our public agencies in taking care of these landscapes in a way that will allow you to enjoy them for a long time to come.
I think that the key point is neither to assume that government has got a plan or has a strong feeling about which way this landscape should go, nor that we can wait much longer to give government a plan. The landscape is changing. It's going to change more rapidly now because of increased storminess along the south coast. We expect to see the meadowlands pretty much disappear in another 15 to 20 years if nothing is done. And as Madrona pointed out, if we don't mobilize local effort on Lopez, there simply will not be enough arms and legs to do the kind of work that has a chance of stabilizing the landscape. And I would argue that we shouldn't be thinking of restoring iceberg in the sense of making it like it was in 1950 or 1850 or 1650. But stabilizing the landscape at a point where it's diverse, where it continues to have the kinds of really cool native animal and plant species that it has, that we don't lose anything that's there, and at the same time that we don't disturb it more in the attempt to save it and potentially lose it all, which I believe is a mistake that we're often making in restoration projects elsewhere.
You've been listening to Living on Lopez, Backyard Conservation, and we've been talking about the special public places on Lopez. Thank you.